The talk is called Fire Up Your Love Light. Some of us know the Grateful Dead. We're deadheads back in the day. Turn on your love light. I think that song was originally written by someone else, but they covered it famously. So we're doing a little bit of a series now on cultivating positive or pleasant emotions. And so we're really talking right now about cultivating warm, friendly feelings. And our ability to love is not just some personality, either defect or asset. It's actually not pre-given. Our ability to love depends very much on our mental habits. And this kind of practice, the loving kindness practice, is all about noticing what mental habits get in the way of being more loving and more open, and letting go of those and cultivating more of what actually helps our heart love. And, you know, it's such a basic thing. We want to love, we want to be loved, and that makes the world go around. So, but we often get in our own way with stuff that's not necessarily very important, kind of petty stuff often, judgmental pettiness. And, you know, we kind of have to really reflect and notice, like, how's that working for us? Are we feeling good, comfortable, happy in our own skin with a mind that's a little bit snippy or that just focuses on what's wrong and doesn't notice what's going well? We don't realize how much we're constructing our world with our thoughts and with what we choose to pay attention to. We pretty much create our world by our mental choices, what we choose to pay attention to. So the Dharma, this side of Dharma practice, is really all about relating, relationship, and super important. And there can be kind of a caricature of a Buddhist meditator, someone who's, you know, sitting in a full lotus, gazing at their navel, you know, while their marriage falls apart, or, you know, the world is falling apart. And that's really a stereotype. That somehow we're just a little bit too focused on our navel. And that's not really the point of this tradition. But here's a cartoon kind of about the stereotype. There's a guy sitting in his living room in full lotus, and his partner is angrily saying to him, "Can you be in the moment later?" So that's the classic stereotype of a dude just kind of like shutting out the relational life so he can just, you know, be in the moment. As opposed to being in the moment with life as it unfolds, internally and externally. That's the point of our practice. When I was in grad school, one of the approaches I was learning was Gestalt therapy, and which is very much about relationship and relational. And one of my professors used to have this expression. This was at Naropa, so we all meditated. But he had this expression, you know, there's quite a few people out there who are over-meditated. and he, meaning, like, they're just meditating, just gazing at their navel and completely ignoring the whole relational life. And that is a really not accurate depiction of what this practice is all about. This practice is to gain clarity about what causes us difficulty and what brings us happiness. And once we're clearer about that, then we can more effectively engage in the world. But it's only half circle to become more clear inwardly. That's only half the circle. Full circle is all the way around to how we can then engage from this more open place. So there's a really famous story in the Pali Canon, the kind of Buddhist scriptures, we could call them. The Buddha's cousin and attendant, Ananda, this will be the classical language translated into English. Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to the Blessed One, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "This is half of the holy life. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie." The Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda. Don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk or nun or a layperson has admirable people as friends, companions, and comrades, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." Our relational life is so central and core that we don't really properly walk the spiritual path without it, the Buddha said. And the way the Buddhist tradition was set up is very much as a group practice. In the Theravada tradition, a monk or a nun cannot even own a penny or a quarter. They can't have money. They can't have food. They never know when their next meal is coming from. This is set up on purpose to create a kind of relationship between the monastic community and the lay community. So the monastics have much more time to practice than lay people, so they tend to bring the spiritual life more closely into the lay community. The lay community, in turn, feeds, houses, and clothes the monastics. So it's very much an interdependent relational social practice. And, you know, it's so well researched now how incredibly relational we are, social animals. And our brain develops in relationship. So our brain doubles from age 0 to 6 months. It doubles again from 6 months to 4 years. And then it only increases about 10% in size up to the age of 18. So our brain is formed almost exclusively, you know, in very early years in very close relationship. We are relational people. So, you know, let's just be really clear. This over-meditated caricature is not something we have to fight against. If we're actually doing the mindfulness practice the way the Buddha meant mindfulness practice, he always talked about it as internal and external mindfulness, inside and relation and outside, and then so internal, external, and internal and external together, meaning relational. So what's on the inside, what's on the outside, and how's the relationship? This is just built into the Buddha's mindfulness instructions. So the essence of the practice is relational. So not only are we not going against the grain to make our mindfulness relational, mindfulness itself is relational. If you didn't know this, what neuroscience is discovering is that mindfulness uses the social circuitry of the brain. So as you're aware of your breath, as you're aware of your body, you're actually being social with yourself. that relational wiring is wired into us very deeply. If we got healthy attachment in our early years, that social circuitry of the brain is very well connected with itself. And actually, mindfulness is easier if there was secure attachment. But most of us probably didn't get secure attachment, many of us, so don't worry about that. It's not like, oh, you had to have gotten that to be mindful. Obviously, we know that's not true. But it's a very similar areas of the brain. Dan Siegel has done a lot of the research on this. So mindfulness is relationship. We're learning wise relationship with ourselves. And that naturally translates into wise relationship, period. Our practice is one of intimacy. All of our stories, all of our rationalizations, our figuring it out, our, you know, all of our usual strategies actually distance us from our raw experience. Mindfulness is dropping that whole filters that we filter our experience through and contacting directly our experience. That's intimate. When we know how to do that internally, we naturally do this externally. We become deeper within, we relate more deeply. So if you're doing just mindfulness practice, if you're doing mindfulness as was actually originally taught, you are doing relational practice. You're not really being over-meditated. But the Buddha also taught a whole other set of more explicitly relational practices. These are four qualities of the awakened heart that are just natural when your mind is clear and awake. And they're kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So the wise heart is a kind heart. When that kind heart meets suffering, compassion arises naturally. When this kind, wise heart sees happiness, this kind of empathetic or sympathetic joy arises naturally. And these qualities are balanced with equanimity, which is a calm but very connected quality. You are at peace as you're very connected to all the chaos of the world. So these are four qualities. And the Buddha said they can be developed limitlessly. They're called the immeasurables. You can't stop developing friendliness in your heart. Kind of cool. But we have to redirect and reorient often to actually let these qualities in our heart flower more. We have to tend our garden. So here's a poem by Galway Kinnell, a part of a poem. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within, of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely. Until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. That's metta. We need to reteach this thing, our heart, its loveliness. And we do that by getting it all the ways we actually obstruct that. Our habits of mind that actually limit our ability to feel warm and friendly. I want to review a little bit some of the principles we talked about last week. So here's one habit. If we can change this habit, it'll help us be friendlier. And the Dalai Lama is very clear about how we confound the actor and an action. What causes trouble are actions. People do things that cause trouble for us sometimes. But what we do, instead of saying, oh, you know, such and such, you know, really affected me this way, right? We don't think that way. We think, what a jerk, what an insensitive person, you know, what a this, what a that. Do you see how the first thing was on focus on actions? The second thing is characterizing their personhood. And we can think, wow, that's a rude person. And then that's who they are. They're just a rude person. They might turn right around, you know, as they turn the corner and hold the door for somebody and be extremely nice, you know? But, you know, they, I don't know what they did. They got in front of you on the sidewalk. You know, they were rude to you. It's their action. It's not the person. We don't know about the person. We can't ascribe motives. We don't know what's really going on in people's hearts. So mostly people are mysterious. But people do things, and those things can harm or benefit. So if we focus on actions, then we can leave the actor out of it, because that's sort of like superstition to characterize a person. We don't know enough to conclude that's a rude person. We know they did something that we thought was rude. That's action language. So we don't know much about people, so we need to find out. We need to be curious about who the actor is. But actually, there's a fair bit of stuff we can know about actors, about people. And this is, you know, the second principle of metta. The first is to separate actor and action. The second is to remember that all actors are human. And if they're human, it's the superficial stuff that makes us different. You know, it's the universal stuff, the stuff we all have in common, is the deep stuff. We all want to be loved and love, right? Who doesn't want that? We all want to be happy. Who doesn't want that? This is the deep stuff. This isn't the superficial stuff. Every single person you meet, every sentient being, every ant is on some path towards well-being, however that is in the ant world. Every sentient being wants well-being. Welcome back. Glad it got resolved.
Emergency song. Now good. Can be present.
Good. Welcome. I've just gone through some of the principles, some of the ways we can be more friendly. And the first one is we separate actor and action. Actions can cause trouble for us or benefit for us, and that we can know. But what we can't know is what the person is behind the actions. So we want to be very careful to oppose action when action is harmful, but still remember that the actor behind the actions is a human being. They're trying to be happy just like us. You might not approve of the way they're doing that. You might not agree with it, but the impulse is the same. We all want to be happy. We're all striving for well-being, even the ant and the fly and the deer. So that's a fellowship. We all have that. Doesn't matter what culture you're from. That's so basic. We all want to love and be loved. We're all vulnerable. No one wants to be heartbroken. No one wants to be scared. No one wants to grow old, get sick, and die. That's the deep stuff, and we all share it. So we separate actor and action. And when we focus on the actors, we tune into shared humanity. Both those things help us be more friendly. We can oppose the harmful action and actually be kind and even friendly towards the person we're opposing. Now that's a trick, but that's this awakened heart, this metta heart of kindness. And you can picture the Dalai Lama just being that. He's going to call, you know, he's going to call it when he sees harm. But he's going to be friendly about it. He's kind of like this global ambassador of kindness. You know, he says, my religion is kindness, but, you know, he got a PhD, his Geshe degree in Tibetan philosophy, Madhyamaka philosophy, at the age of 16. This is a brilliant man. Brilliant, but he doesn't wear that. All of his logic helps him be kind. He knows logic so well, he knows that kindness is what makes sense. So he says, kindness is my religion. So a third principle of being more warm and friendly, more loving, is we have to get it that we have a negativity bias of the brain. This is a human trait. The brain recognizes, stores, and recalls, quote-unquote, negative information much better than it does positive. As Vipassana teacher Rick Hansen says, our mind is like Teflon for positive experiences and Velcro for negative ones.
Why is that?
Is that learned?
Why?
Why?
Why is that? Well, we can only theorize. The theory is that in our evolutionary past, the super checked out dude is like, you know, whatever, it's all good. Chomp. Chomp, exactly. They became like saber-toothed tiger food or lion food or whatever. But those of us, all of us, who are like, what's that sound? What was that? You know, we actually had a better survival chance, supposedly. So that's the natural selection theory. But isn't it interesting? Evolution is sloppy. So it also gave us all a brain that can totally counteract the negativity bias. You know, I mean, how often is our life threatened anymore? How much do we really need to be like freaking out about everything, right? It's rare, you know? I mean, unless you're driving. that's another story. So we need to, if we want to feel more loving, we need to actively seek out what's right with this person, with this situation, and with me. Catch yourself doing something right. Apparently that's a new, you know, management mantra in corporate America. Catch your employees doing something right. Well, if it's good enough for corporate America, might it be good enough for us to really actively look for what's going well? Here's just one tiny little example. We are so clueless, but let's clue in. Just take your fingers to one side of your Adam's apple and close your eyes and feel your heartbeat. Really get a good feel of your pulse. Can you feel how strong your heart is? Whether you had a good day, a bad day, you're old, you're young, this heart is in there powerfully distributing oxygenated, nutrient-rich blood through your body. How's that for something going right today? All day long, 60, 70, 80 times a minute, something is going very right. This gift of being alive is a 70 or 80 beats a minute miracle. Who's doing that heartbeat? Isn't it amazing? a lot is going right. But, you know, do you have any resistance to this? If you do, you're up against your evolutionary past. It's the negativity bias. So, to be reality-based, it is not Pollyanna to focus on the positive. We need to counteract the negativity bias. So that's a third principle of being more loving. A fourth principle is very, very helpful. There's a story about, I don't remember what, you know, Indian wise teacher in the, you know, back in the day, in the 60s and 70s when we were all going over to India. But this is, I don't know if it's Joseph or Sharon or one of the early Vipassana teachers, but they had a friend who had a really difficult relationship with his mom. And, you know, he was talking to this teacher who said, it's so frustrating because my mom and I just don't get along, and really, truthfully, I just want to love her. And the teacher said, she can't stop you from loving her. Nobody can stop you from loving. You can love. You might have conflict, you might have issues, you can still love her. So we can be the love that we are wanting to get from someone else. When we orient to metta practice and kindness practice and let our minds rest in our own kind wishes for others or ourselves, we become the love we're seeking. And then we can love so much better. We can let our rebellious teenager be rebellious. Because what I read recently is a psychoanalyst and child development expert, D.H. Winnicott, he said something like, the teenager's job is to annihilate his parents or her parents. Now, he means psychically. Their job is to completely rebel so they can figure out who the hell they are. They don't know their yes, really, until they know their no, you know, to some degree. So we can, like, withstand that with metta. We can have a lot of conflict in a house of teenagers, right? But when we're not activated or Twitter-baited, and we calm down, we realize we can still love them as they're totally thinking we're so uncool. And mom, you're so embarrassing, you know, don't hug me in front of my friends, whatever, right? We can still practice love for them. We can be the love that we're not getting from them. So that's a fourth principle, is with our own practice, we get a lot more, we come sort of pre-approved, you know? We feel pre-loved, so we can just let people be who they are, and then we can be curious, and we can silently, secretly send them metta. They won't know. Okay, a fifth principle is that we get into a lot of trouble by confusing attached love with loving kindness. Loving kindness in the Buddhist world, love in the Buddhist world, is really simply defined as wishing well for somebody. Attached love is trying to get what we want from them. How's that for really different energy? One energy is this, gimme. And the other energy is, may you be happy. Very different. So our relationships are tough, aren't they? A lot because of this desire. We have a lot of desire. And this is not to judge it. It's just to notice that we are often getting in our own way of actually being more loving. So just a few cartoons about the difficulty of attached love. Two praying mantises, the female saying to the male, if you don't know praying mantis natural history, you will soon. The female is saying, after we have sex, but before I kill you, I'm going to need your help with some shelves.
Praying mantis.
How's that? Actually, the way it works, and I'm a former wildlife biologist, but apparently the female bites the male's head off in mid-sex, and that helps the male pump even harder. So how's that for a way to go out, you know? So anyway.
Whoa.
So.
I don't want to be a praying mantis.
Good thing we're not, right? That's their way of being happy, right? Seems to work in the praying mantis world. So ours is not to judge, right? So we all know this. Just a very simple thing for you to take away from tonight is notice with your partner or a close friend how much of your energy is going towards trying to get something from them versus silently, secretly sending them a simple, kind wish. And if we orient this way, we get a lot more friendly in our loving relationships. And again, of course we have needs. Of course we're going to try to get our needs met. But you can stop sometimes and just say, huh, how's this working for me? What if I turn the tables to just see how that felt? So that's just a suggestion. And then, so the 21st century has invented a brand new relational barrier. Thank you, Steve Jobs and Al Gore, you know, who invented the internet, and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and blah, 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 right? This is, yes, the internet is incredible and amazing, and doesn't it kind of get in the way? You know, how many feel, some of you very well might, how many of you feel that your social life is actually much better now that you're part of the internet? Does anyone want to raise their hand with that? I don't do Facebook, but, you know, I know Facebook can be really great for some. Some people like it, but not one hand went up. Okay.
It's like a phone book for me, not Facebook.
Just a phone book?
Yeah, it feels happier when I don't use it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, studies show that social media, the more you use social media, the higher anxiety and depression go up, the more anxiety and depression. What used to happen with bullying, say, for somebody, you know, in school, as awful as that is, they could leave it when they left school. But now with internet bullying, it's 24/7. That's just one example where social media actually can be very problematic. So, and yet, it can be great. You know, some people find support groups, you know, for something, you know, that they can't find in other ways. So, you know, not to completely knock it, but. So this was actually on Facebook, so it's kind of parodying itself because it's also damning the internet at the same time. But my partner Lisa found this on the internet. I don't know the whole backstory, but you'll see there's a picture of a guy on a boat in the middle of the ocean on his phone as a whale is breaching right next to him. And the story that I've heard is he didn't ever see this whale. There were photographers taking pictures of whales breaching, and this guy never looked up from his phone. Yikes. You know, you might hear this in your next meditation class. In your mind's browser, this is the teacher giving the instructions. In your mind's browser, clear your cache. Now delete your history. Now navigate to a blank web page. That's what we're becoming. So, you want to feel more metta, you know, just really start discriminating when social media is working for you. When does it actually, you know, increase your social life, and when does it get in the way, you know? And then use it. Don't let it use you. You know, let it be your servant, not your master. So this is just kind of, these are sort of the basic, simple metta principles. We're going to do a metta practice, which is a meditation practice, where we actually help ourselves feel more friendly and warm, and it feels good. But let me just stop for now. We'll take a break shortly, but let's, you know, invite your input, anything you want to respond with or question or sharing.
Earlier,
yeah.
You used the word purposeful.
Yeah.
What were you referring to? Is it purposeful mindfulness?
Yes. Okay. Purposeful mindfulness.
As in, is there a difference basically between being mindful, say, about driving or doing dishes or drinking tea, versus choosing a different mindset, choosing to be more loving in that moment? It's kind of a higher arcade.
Yeah, good question. And I just repeat for the mic.
Okay.
So the question is purposeful mindfulness, using purposefulness that way, different from using it to kind of change your mind to be more loving? They are different, because mindfulness is a practice of just being aware of what is exactly as it is. We're not trying to change anything, right? And it's non-conceptual. We're not using our thoughts. We're actually opening to just pure awareness, right? The awareness of breath, not our thoughts about the breath, right? So this other stream of practice is actually using thoughts to change ourselves. So it is a different style of purposefulness. Yeah.
That's a good word.
What else? Do you believe you get in your own way?
Yes.
With loving? With loving?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it feels like, because we have 10 paramis.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like it's sort of like you're trying to balance 10 fingers.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you work on, let's say, determination,
yes,
or effort or equanimity or truth, you know, you kind of tend to shorten on loving kindness.
Yes.
And so, like, for me, it's sort of like trying to bring and haul everything and trying to,
yeah,
balance it can be hard because,
yes,
I'm so human.
Yes, exactly. So for people who don't know, the paramis are in the Theravada tradition called the 10 perfections of the Buddha, or the awakened heart. So, and there's a bunch of them, and you just named a bunch of them. So yes, it's hard to do all 10 at once, but you know, if you really do one well, then the others, you know, line up a little bit more. If you're really truthful, you know, you're going to be more equanimous. You're probably going to be more kind, but depends how we're being truthful. That's don't always go together. But, you know, if you're more ethical, you know, the equanimity, kindness, you know, they're pretty interlinked. So, you know, I think what's good with the paramis is to really focus on one that you're kind of, oh, this is cool to work on this one, you know. It's kind of like it's either right at your edge, or you're just, it's got your interest piqued, you know. Because truthfulness, I mean, how huge a practice would that be? To actually be truthful, and to discern when is it useful to be truthful and when isn't it. Because, you know, the Buddha said being truthful with our speech is very important when it's useful. You're not going to blurt out every passing thought in your mind, because we'd all drive each other crazy if we did that, right? So
it's interesting because in the past I would work on metta,
yes,
metta.
Yes.
and that sort of prevented me because I love harmony.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of curve out truthfulness to
I see.
Harmony.
Right.
And now I feel like
right.
my edge is
yes.
truthfulness.
Right.
And that's sort of like sometimes a sacrifice.
Right.
And, a little bit. So.
Well, what about this? What if you could bring the two together in this distinction between actor and action? So truthfulness would be seeing someone did something that you feel is harmful. And you can totally have that because you're focusing just on an action, but you're not characterizing the person, the actor, with their action. And so you can still be kind to the person, but you don't have to approve or condone harmful behavior.
You're not
that's
really
one.
Judging.
Yeah, you're not exactly. You're not judging. Like, wow, that is a really blah 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 person. You're saying more like, whoa, look at the cause and the effect. They did this, and this is what happened. And that's truthfulness. We don't want to not see that. We need to see it. You know, I mean, we need to be truthful. But we can be very kind. and truthful if we separate actor and action. Does that make sense? So. so. Okay. So we'll take a short break.